the boy said, I have kashas. I have questions, you know, very fundamental questions, actually three very fundamental questions, which prevent me from doing anything. So Reb Chaim said, I'd be happy to hear them. But I have one question myself before you ask me those questions. These questions that you have, did you have them before you left the yeshiva or after you left the yeshiva? Because if you had them before the yeshiva, then they're questions, I could definitely answer them. But if you only had these questions after you left, then they're not questions, they're answers. And you can't give an answer to an answer. So we have no conversation here. So that's Baruch Hashem, we're here. We can learn what the text actually says. We can have our questions answered. Let's start with Pasuk Aleph, two-thirds of the way down, Perek Chaf Pasuk Aleph. Vayisa Misham Avram Arza HaNegev. So this was what happened to the last parak was the incident with Lot and his daughters. And now Avram traveled from there. He went southwards. Vayesha ben Kadosh ben Shur. And he resided in a certain place between Kadosh and Shur. Vayagar b'Gerar. And he dwelled in Gerar, which was, everything was not Jewish at that time. That was an area of the Plishtim at that moment. But if we look at Rashi, Rashi says, where's the Rashi? In the middle of the second column. When he saw that Sodom and the villages were all destroyed, and then there were no more passerbys, meaning Avraham, his whole avoda to Hashem was based on doing chesed to people. But in order to do chesed to people, you need people to do chesed to. So when the whole population of that area was destroyed in the destruction of Sodom and Amorah, there were no more recipients of chesed anymore. There was nobody there with whom Avram could work. So Nasal Misham. So he moved on from there. Rav Yerucham in Das Torah speaks out about this. He said that when we are involved in our avoda, our work for Hashem, and what we consider the purpose of our lives, we often tend to take a lackadaisical and fairly lazy attitude towards what needs to be done. That if we were in business, he says, and let's say you have a big company with stockholders and everything, and their product lines are slipping. So they say, well, people aren't interested in these specific products we're selling anymore, with the features we're selling. So that's it. I mean, what are we supposed to do? So you know what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to, pivot a little bit, make a new product, or add new features to the product you have, or sell differently, or whatever it is. You have to build business. You don't just say, there's nothing there anymore. So he said the same thing with our avoda to Hashem. Okay, maybe you're not in a position right now where it's optimal. Maybe you find challenges, so figure out what you need to get past that. If your avoda is to do chesed to people, and right now you can't, so what do you have to do? For Avram, the answer was, move somewhere where you could do chesed. He said that has to be the Jew's perspective. Treat your religion as a business. You have goals, you have objectives. Do what it takes to accomplish those objectives. Rashi continues, Davar Acher, Esrachek Milot. Why did Avram move? He wanted to distance himself from Lot. Sheyatza alav shemra, Lot all of a sudden acquired a really bad reputation, Shabal Benosa, because he had relations with his daughters. And that was antithetical to what Avram stood for, and it cast a pall due to his proximity to Lot. So in order for Avram to be successful, he had to cut ties with Lot, so that Lot's bad behavior shouldn't reflect poorly on Avraham himself.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So two things. Did Avraham, he didn't live in Sodom.
He lived adjacent, but not in Sodom.
Oh, he lived in that area.
Right, right.
Okay. Yeah. And the second thing, I'm a little confused about the moral aspect of Lot, because you said, on the one hand, that his daughters, succumbed to that or whatever because they wanted future generation.
Right.
The other hand, I know you said that Lot, at first he didn't know, but then when he knew, that's why he was punished or whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
But I don't know which one, Is it true that maybe they needed to have relations with them to for the next generation?
That's what they certainly thought. And because of their good thoughts, meaning their actions, bore fruit in terms of the fact that future descendants from that union became Jewish royalty, which eventually leads to Mashiach through the Davidic line. But Lot himself, who knew that what they were doing was wrong, he himself was castigated for the act. Meaning you can have one act committed by two people and the response to the two different perpetrators can be very different depending on what their intentions were going in.
Okay. This story also reminds a little bit of Noah, right?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But in case Noah's kids were also responsible, right? They were punished. His son, yeah.
In terms of castrating Noah, is that what you're talking
right,
about?
Right, right.
So there, he had one son who castrated him, yes.
Right.
And he was punished, yeah. Right, Noah wasn't really held at fault there.
Oh,
Noah, what?
He was not held at fault.
Oh.
Okay, Pasuk Bez. Yomer Avram Osar Ishto. So now, Avram tells Sarah his wife, Achosihi. It must be then, she is my sister. What do you mean? He told his wife she is my sister? No. Obviously, we're translating something wrong there. We'll have to see what Rashi says about the word El. But Yishlach Avimelech Melech Gror, and the king of that area where they were, Gror, sent, Vayikach Sarah, and he took Sarah, meaning he took her for his to be his own wife. So if you look in Rashi here, at the bottom of the left column, Vayomer Avraham, Kam lo natal rishos. Here, Avraham didn't take rishos from Sarah to make the claim that she's his sister. We saw before that when they were about to go into Mitzrayim, Avram asked Sarah, could you please do the following favor for me? I don't want to be killed. So please say that we're not married, but rather that we're brother and sister. Here Avram didn't ask her. El al korcha shloba tavosa, he did it against her will. Lefish kar locha lebeis para aidekin, because she had already been taken via a similar ruse to the house of Paro, she had been forcibly taken as well. We're going to see why Avraham did this. If he already had experience like this, then why is he repeating similar actions? And Rashi continues, El Sari Ishto, Al Sari Ishto. So here, El does not mean to, it means about or regarding. Al Sari Ishto. It means regarding Sarah, his wife, that she was his sister, Kiyotzibo. And then Rashi brings other examples throughout Tanakh where we see that the word El, too, can actually mean not El, too, but rather Al, which means regarding. Okay. The Ramban on this pasuk says, and we're going to see allusions to this in the Psukim themselves later as well, Avram did this. The reason why he entered Gror to begin with, didn't he learn his lesson from Mitzrayim already? He had a very beautiful wife. He went into Mitzrayim. And he knew something might happen, so that's why he went with the ruse to say that they were brother and sister instead of being married. But she got kidnapped, basically, by Paro at that point. Why is he doing something which could lead to the same circumstances? And the Ramban says, as we're going to see, that this Gror was a whole different country. It was apples and oranges. Mitzrayim, they knew, was, so to speak, the equivalent of a bad neighborhood. You're going in, you're asking for trouble. And he was forced to go. There was a famine, there was this, that, whatever the reason was, he had to go. But Gror, where it was somewhat volitional, he didn't think Gror had a reputation as a very moral, conservative, like very good place to live. And he had no conception that such a thing could happen in such a place. That's why he didn't ask her permission first. He didn't think it was gonna happen. The Ramban also says, he points out, that at this point in time, Sarah is 89 years old. About a year, she's going to have a baby, Yitzchak, which she delivers when she's 90 years old. So Avraham, the Ramban asked the question, why was Avraham so worried about some king who wanted a trophy wife taking his 89-year-old wife, Sarah? So the Ramban says, based on Chazal, and we saw in Rashi's previously as well, that a miracle happened to Sarah, that when the Malach informed Avram and Sarah that she was going to have a baby, she had already been passed biologically the time when she could have a baby, in order for that to happen, she had to be rejuvenated, revived in some way, that her whole biology, her whole makeup had to be innovated again. At that time, we saw, again, when she was making the matzahs or the bread that Avram was going to serve to the angels, Chazal say that she was pierced in Nida. Her menstruation began again. Her whole system got rejuvenated. And that meant all the good things that come with it, meaning it was like a super hormone therapy. Her wrinkles disappeared, her skin became beautiful, everything was, she became a young woman again.
Yes.
So because of that reality, then she became an object of desire once more. And indeed, Abimelech, the king of Gerar, took her when she came into the country. If we continue in Pasuk Gimel, Vayavo, God came to Abimelech in a dream at night. And God said to him, you're going to die for the woman. In Chumash, Isha doesn't just mean a woman, it means a married woman. That's the normal connotation of the word Isha. You're going to die because of this married woman which you took. She's already attached to somebody. She's married. And yet you took her, and that's a capital crime. The pasuk continues, Abimelech lo karav eilaha. Abimelech never got close to her. Here, karav has a connotation of physical intimacy. He was never able to be intimate with her as his plan had been. Vayomer, and because of that, he told God within the dream, Hashem, hagoy gam tzadik taro? Will you punish somebody who's righteous? Meaning, he's going to justify himself now, but A, I didn't know she was married, and B, we didn't do anything. So why are you killing me, Hashem? Nothing has happened yet. Let's see Rashi here. Dalet, the top line. Lo karvelaha, he had not come close to her. He had not been intimate with her. Hamalach mono. It wasn't because he hadn't tried, but rather the malach had held him back. Hashem sent a malach, an angel or a force, which prevented Abimelech from engaging with Sarah in a physical manner. Kamosh Namar, as it says, Luna Satika, we're going to see this in a few psukim, Hashem tells him, I did not permit you, Lingoa Elaha, to touch her. Other Meforshim understand this to mean, based on other Midrashim, that when it says Hashem sent a Malach, it meant for that night at least, he destroyed Abimelech's libido. He totally took away any desire that Abimelech had for Sarah, thereby rendering him impotent and unable to do anything with Sarah. And that's how Hashem protected Sarah from Abimelech. And then Abimelech's argument, Rashi continues, Hagoy gam tzadik tarog, will you kill somebody who's righteous? Afim hu tzadik targenu? It's a rhetorical question. Even if he's righteous, are you going to kill him, Hashem? Shemakak dar kacha. Maybe that's the way you do things, Hashem. You know, I'm not telling you what to do, Abimelech said. Maybe that's how you play. That la'abed humus chinam. Maybe you just destroy people for no reason. Kacha sis l'dor mabul. Maybe that's what happened with the big flood where everybody died. L'dor flaga, and when you punish people by disseminating them all over the world. Afani omer. So I'm going to say also, sheraktim alo davar. People are going to say about me, oh, Hashem killed him for no reason. He didn't do anything. So fine. So Abimelech is making a kiddush or chilal Hashem argument here that Hashem, okay, fine. If you want people to say bad things about you, then you could kill me. But otherwise, like, what's happening here? This is actually even though it sounds like Abimelech is being sarcastic, the concept is a true one. That the concept of Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, or Chol Hashem, or doing things which shed a negative element on God's name, that is, it's circumstantial, let's say like that. Ideally, it should not be circumstantial. Ideally, there should be an objective morality, whatever the Torah said, whatever Hashem says is moral, that's moral. And then who cares if people view it properly or not? If you're doing the right thing, you're doing the right thing. And sometimes we say that, yes, you have to behave that way. As long as you know you're doing the right thing, then you have to ignore the sideways glances of other people. However, sometimes we say you should also take into account you can't not do the right thing. But you also have to make it palatable to people who might be observing you, so that for them, they don't understand your conception of morality. They might have a different conception, and where they're standing or the place that they're in mentally at that moment, they need to see something else in order to bring them closer to Hashem. Your enforcement of objective morality might actually push people away because they don't understand what's happening. So for them, you have to make it something that is also palatable to them. We see this halacha. There are certain financial differences between the way we treat Jews and the way we treat non-Jews in the halacha. So for instance, if there's a lost object, the Torah says you have to return, if the owner's Jewish, you have to return it to him. There's a mitzvah of returning lost objects to Jews. There is no mitzvah to return a lost object to a non-Jew. Why is that? Why do we draw that distinction? This was actually, these kinds of distinctions were something that the Gemara in Bava Kama says that the Romans were very interested in, that they sent people to learn in the yeshiva by the times of the Tanaim, circa the year 200 CE, and they were very happy with everything taught except for these kinds of halachas where there was a distinction between Jew and non-Jew. So the Maharal Miprag says the philosophy behind these distinctions is not that we're somehow negating the Romans, like negating non-Jews or disparaging them or treating them as second-class citizens. It's actually the opposite. There's a baseline morality, financial morality, that exists with the entire world. However, with your brother, with your sister, with your family, obviously you're not going to go with a baseline, meaning for the rest of the world, we have rules and laws and everybody does business with each other. But if your brother owes you money, you're not going to sue him, right? Then he's your brother, and so he can't pay you back. Fine, you're not going to force him to go in bankruptcy because of it. Or similar kinds of things. We're going to go out, we're going to show chesed in a big way to our family members because they're a family. And that's not tenable for the world at large. Meaning, in order for business to work, in order for the world to run, you have to have, you know, your money's yours, my money's mine, and we have a court system and a business system, which capitalism, which grows the money based on understood rules. And when it's your family, we don't follow those rules. We're nice to our family members in ways that, you know, strictly financially don't make sense. But it's because they're our family. So that's what the Maharal says about those halachos, that it's not that we're denigrating non-Jews. The opposite, we're treating them 100% equally and fairly. They're not our family, though. For our family, we do special favors for. That being said, the halacha does say, let's say the non-Jew knows you have what belongs to him. And technically, finders keepers. He doesn't have the rights to it anymore. But he doesn't understand that. So that being the case, if it's going to cause a chilal Hashem, and you're going to profane God's name by not returning it, then you have to return it, even though the absolute morality is that you are not required to return it. But because he doesn't understand that, in order to draw him closer to God, to help him progress on his journey, you do have to return it because from his perspective, that's the right thing to do at the moment. So that's similar to the argument Avimelech is making here. Avimelech is saying, Hashem, you might be correct, but I don't get it. The world at large doesn't get it. So you're actually going to do disservice to whatever it is you're trying to accomplish. If we continue in Pasukei, in the second line of the Chumash, Avimelech continues to plead his case to God. Halo hu amar li, but he said to me, meaning Avram said to me, Achusi, she is my sister. Vihi gami amra achihu, and she also said that he is my brother. Besam levavi, with the purity of my heart, the v'nikion kapai, the innocence of my hands, asisi zos. I did this, meaning I took her because I truly believed they weren't married. I believe she was his sister. If we look in Rashi here, five lines down, hey, gam hi, the rabbas of Adam Gmalum Chamorim, also she. What do you mean, also she? Meaning she said, but whenever you have the word gam in Chumash, it's generally understood that it's including something that's not stated explicitly. So here the Medrash, Rashi quoting the Medrash, what is the word gam also coming to include? The rabbis of Adab Gamalim Chamarim, to include the slaves, the camel drivers, the donkey drivers that were part of Avram's retinue. As kulam sha'alti, all of them I asked for Amrli, and they all said to me, Achiyahu, that he is her brother. So right away we see that something's funny going on. Why did Abimelech feel the need to ask everybody, right? If Avram said, this is my sister, so fine, then she's your sister. But obviously something wasn't correct, and Abimelech sensed that. So he asked Sarah, are you his sister, really? And she said, yes, I'm his sister. So then he still wasn't happy with that. And he asked everybody that was in Avram's company, like, are they really brother and sister? And everybody said, yes, yes. So clearly Abimelech himself realized something else was going on. He's not the innocent person that he's portraying himself
as. She didn't have a saying like at the time, like if a king wants to take somebody, they cannot say no, like at the time. You know, Sarah could say, oh, I don't want to marry you or something.
Was she, according to the secular law of the time, allowed to refuse the king?
Exactly, yeah.
No. Yeah. But we're going to see what she did say. We're going to see, in the very last pasuk of this parak, we're going to see that she had spoken up. But we'll have to.
I'm confused, because didn't you say that this time Avram again had her, let her go to him or something?
Avram didn't realize he was going to face the same situation he faced in Egypt with the king kidnapping his wife. That's why he entered into the country to begin with. He thought he was safe there, but all of a sudden when he saw that indeed the king took her, he realized his life was at stake, and he quickly reverted without Sarah's permission to the, it's not mistruth as we're going to see, but not the whole truth, just saying she's his sister but not his wife.
He was afraid to be killed again.
He was afraid to be killed. Yeah, and here the Mefarshim speak out that there seems to be somewhat of a moral inconsistency. Like, why is he afraid to be killed? If it's such a righteous country, then it should be righteous both for adultery and for murder. Why would he suspect them of murder but not adultery? So they say that that really morality, when you don't have a God-inspired morality, but rather you're driving the morality on your own, it's a self-inspired morality, we're all subject to our desires. So that if I want something, I'm going to find a way to justify it, or at least find a way that's the least bad way that I can get it. So in terms of if Sarah was really this beautiful object of desire, she was royalty and everything else, like the best wife a person could have, then Avimelech, how is he going to justify it? How, in a moral society, how are people going to justify taking her every time Avimelech's with Sarah, he's going to be over a prohibition of adultery? So they say, but if he kills Avraham, okay, murder is a one-time thing. It's over and done with. And then Sarah's free the rest of the time. So which one's worse? Multiple averas of adultery or a one-time avera of murder? Well, if you're going to have Sarah, you know, by hook or by crook, so you go with the least bad, which is somehow conspiring to have Avram killed. So Avimelech continues in Rashi here. He said, "B'sam levavi, you know, with the purity of my heart, shelo demisilachto, I didn't think that to sin with her, unikah and kapai, with innocence on my hands, naki ani menachet, that I am clean here from this sin, shelo nagati ba, I never even touched her," Avimelech says. So here, Avimelech is alluding to what's actually a dialectic in terms of mitzvahs and averas alike, that every mitzvah and every avera actually has two core components to it. There's the component of Hashem created the world. Hashem created the world based on what the Torah says, meaning there's a God's conception, his das, his knowledge, and his morality. What we don't understand what that is, but whatever that is, it found its expression within the creation of the world. So everything in the world reflects God's knowledge and morality. that and his will. That being said, there's a way, you know, a user's manual, if you want to bring out Hashem's das and the way he feels the world should be used correctly, because that's the way it was created, then here are the mitzvahs. And the way you break the world, meaning going against God's will, that's the averas. But it has an effect in the world itself. You're actually, even though we don't see it, that's part of, you know, the trick of us being created, is that God puts blinders on us so we can't see immediately the consequences of our actions. But if we have the eyes to see, then when you do mitzvahs, you're actually creating, you're building. And you're building in, you know, on a spiritual plane, which in the world to come, a person will have the eyes to see all the greatness that he or she built with their mitzvah observance. And conversely, Chas v'Shalom for averus as well. When a person does sin, they're engaged in an act of destruction. They're actually destroying the spiritual underpinnings of the world in ways that they can't conceive of. They think they're doing a small avera. It's not true. It's actually something catastrophic. That's one element of mitzvahs and averus. There's another element of mitzvahs and averus that God expressed his will as the king. Irrelevant of consequences, just because God said, and that itself is, you know, reason enough to do mitzvahs. I want to do the will of God. And conversely, if I don't do the will of God, I do an avera, it means I'm rebelling against God. Then I'm actively engaged in an act of rebellion, saying, God, I don't treat you as my king, and therefore I'm doing this avera. That being the case, that, you know, that treason has a death penalty. And these two elements, both the actual consequences as well as the implication of God's sovereignty, apply in every mitzvah and avera. So Abimelech is referencing this as well. The first time he said, "B'sam levavi, I didn't have a thought to sin," meaning in no way did I want to impugn upon God's mastery of the world. And secondly, this in my hands, I never touched her. I never actually did an avera, which could break something. There was no physical consequences either. So that being the case, Hashem, from either aspect, why are you punishing me? Both elements of the avera, I did not engage in. So Hashem responds to the Melech. Pasukov, Vayomer Elav, Halukim, Bachalom. So Hashem responded to him in the dream. Gam Anochi Yadati, I know also, ki besam levavcha sisa zos, that you did it with an innocence. Ve'echzol gam Anochi oscha mechatoli. But I was the one who held you back from sinning to me. Meaning, I know what you wanted to do. It's not because you're so righteous that you didn't do the avera. I held you back from doing the avera. Alkein lo nesaticha l'nego eilah. That's why I did not permit you to touch her. I was protecting you, Avimelech. It's not because you're so innocent, but because you're righteous enough that I stepped in to not allow you to do this avera. Va'ata hashev esha se'ish, and now return this married woman, ki navihu, because her husband is a prophet, or a righteous man, and he will daven for you, and live, meaning you will live because of his tefillah. Unless Avram davens for you, you're going to die. If you don't return her, da kimos tamos, know that you will surely die. Ata b'chol shaloch, you and all of those who are with you, meaning you and your entire household, will be killed here. If we look in Rashi and Pasuk Vav, Rashi says, Yadat ki b'sam levavcha v'gomer, I know that in your innocence you did this. Emesh shelo demisa mitchila achto, I know that initially you didn't think to sin. Avon nekiyas kapayim ein kan, but innocence, no, that's not here. Meaning you had bad intentions. Meaning Hashem knows what we're thinking. He knows what Avimelech was trying to do. The fact that somebody superficially would see that Avimelech hadn't done anything, that doesn't hold water with Hashem, because Hashem knows what Avimelech was trying to do. So he's calling him out on that. Don't play the innocent card, Avimelech. Hashem is very cognizant of our internal emotions and plans as well. The Gadolim were very well aware, they worked on themselves tremendously, to be aware of their own internal emotions also, because unless you know yourself, then you're never quite in control of yourself. It's also another story with Chaim Voloshin, is that when there was once somebody came to town collecting, in those days, as today, every day there would be collectors in town from going all over the place, collecting money for very good causes, and people would give. So in the town of Voloshin, a collector came through, and a very impressive person, and everybody gave to him, except for Reb Chaim Voloshin. And it was conspicuous that he didn't give to this collector. So then after a while, it was found out that the collector was actually a missionary, and he was collecting for not good objectives. And the townspeople then came to Reb Chaim Voloshin, and they said, Ruach HaKodesh, obviously you have some kind of divine inspiration that you knew not to give to this person. He said, it's not true. Nobody can claim, that kind of divine inspiration today. Why didn't I give to this person? He said, really, I was about to give. I was reaching into my pocket to pull out money to give to this person. He said, but then I realized I really wanted to give to him, and I didn't feel any compulsion not to. We have a general principle, Reb Chaim Voloshin said, that when you're going to do something good, your Yetzirah attacks you, that there's always some resistance to doing something good. So normally when you give tzedakah, you feel very good about giving tzedakah, but you're also thinking about how you're not going to be able to buy whatever it is you were thinking about buying because you're writing the check to this guy instead. There's always a little bit of your Yetzirah trying to stop you, to make you feel bad about spending the money. He said, I didn't feel that. So because of that, I realized something's wrong with this situation. I really wanted to give him without any hesitancy. So I didn't give him. And it turned out he wasn't, there's a reason why the Yetzer Hara was not engaged at that moment. Fine. if we look in Rashi, in Pasuk Zion, Hashem Eshes Ha'ish, return this married woman. So now this is very interesting. This we start getting into more what we call modern emotional conceptions that, but it's Chazal talking, that Amimach, don't make the argument that because you took his wife from him and she was maybe sullied at your hands, that he's going to be dismissive of her in some way. Which unfortunately we find in other cases, whenever something happens of an intimate nature outside of a marriage, it's always an issue for even if they reconcile the couple, it's an issue forever within that marriage, to whatever degree. So Hashem is telling Abimelech, don't think that she will be lowly in his eyes for some, or disparaged in his eyes, even subconsciously in some way, and that he won't take her back. When you return her, when you let her out of your palace, or maybe even if he takes her back, maybe he'll hate you for for the damage you did to his wife or to their relationship, to their marriage.
But then it wouldn't be her fault, right? Sarah wouldn't be held accountable because she'd be kind of a rape, right?
We're just talking about human nature. V'lo yispa alecha, and that if he hates you, he's not going to daven for you. And skip to the next Rashi. Ki navihu, that's not concerned because he's a navi. He'll know that nothing happened. That even though you had her at night and in the same bedroom, in the same bed, that you didn't touch her, because he's a navi. Don't worry about him suspecting about what may have happened. Lefikach, and because he knows that nothing happened, yispala ba'adcha. He will daven for you. Meaning, if you ask him to daven, because otherwise you're going to die for taking Sarah, because he knows nothing happened, he will be willing to daven for you. The Radak on this pasuk. Well, I just we'll get to finish the parak, but this conception of intimacy between a man and a woman as a bedrock of a marriage, meaning that there can't be even the least hesitancy in their emotional connection to each other, is really a conception of marriage which unfortunately doesn't find its way into the practical world as much as we would like. But ideally, the Torah says a husband and wife share a relationship where there's no divide between them whatsoever in any way at all. They have to have perfect both faith, trust, but also compatibility with each other in order to function properly as that ideal couple. The Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, who is the Rosh Hashiva in Torah Vadas, in, I guess it was in the 1960s maybe, that at that time, there are a lot of, let's say, Gedolim in America, great, great people, who certainly the world at large has never heard of. Meaning they're well known in certain circles, but outside those small circles, most people haven't heard of them, and certainly the next generation hasn't heard of them, even though they were tremendous and huge individuals. So one of those people, his name was Yonasan Steif. He was the Rav of Kahal Das Yeraim, the Wiener community, the Wiener Kehillah in Williamsburg, and he was a tremendous person, and so much so that the Satmar Rebbe Zatzal wanted him to take over, you know, a much bigger role, and Rabbi Yonasan Steif said, no, I refuse, because he was focused on what at that time was a small community. But he said, my time is already 100%, you know, maximized or optimized just working with my people, like my small kehillah. I'm not going to be any more effective like with big, meaning it'll just be at a loss of my effectiveness. So he chose to remain small. He did introduce certain halachas which have become commonplace in the world at large today. In those days, when we speak about glatt kosher, right? Everything today is glatt kosher. What does that mean, that something's glatt? What does the word glatt actually mean? So, and what does it mean if something's kosher without being glatt kosher? Is it still kosher? What is glatt adding? So glatt is actually a technical term. That means smooth, when something's smooth. So how's that apply to kashrus? When one slaughters an animal, in order for it to be kosher, in addition for it to be a kosher animal, it has to have a kosher shechita, it can't be a trefa. It can't be suffering from a list, you know, the Gemara talks about what the list is, but a list of certain prescribed illnesses or injuries within the animal that would render it fatal, that it would die within a year. So, for instance, like if it has a hole, or let's say its kidney is perforated, or something, lesions on the lung, or other kinds of serious conditions, then it's called treif, and you're not allowed to eat that animal, even though it was shechted properly and it's a kosher animal. A large percentage of animals today are treif, meaning when you have a kosher butcher operation, then many of the animals that they slaughter, they don't know until after the fact, but many of the animals that they slaughter are not sold to kosher consumers because they end up having these internal trefos within them that render them unfit, halachically unfit to eat. So there are certain cases, though, where there could be an argument amongst the poskim or something which, let's say an argument amongst the Rishonim, like earlier generations, where it could be they were lenient for a while in terms of whether we should observe certain stringencies or not, and then the world accepted those stringencies. So one of those is what's called glatt kosher. It's referring specifically to the lungs of an animal. Animal lungs, cow, sheep, tend to grow certain kinds of lesions on them, and whether or not the lesion qualifies as a treif or not, so there's a difference of opinion what qualifies. If you can peel it off and the animal's still whole, meaning the lungs still intact, or things like that, you can actually check for it if there's holes in the lungs. It's very informative and interesting. If anybody ever has a chance to visit a kosher meat processing company, I would highly encourage it. It's eye-opening. But you could even check the lungs by inflating them, taking them out, blowing them up, and see if they contain air or not, or if they have holes in them. So there is a question about the lesions, the holes in it. Is it smooth, or was there a scar? There was not a scar there. For many generations, the Jews were lenient just because meat was so expensive, kosher meat was hard to come by, to eat what was considered not glop. Even if it's not smooth, even if there was lesions to some degree, they accepted it as kosher, relying on the opinions that said it was okay, and that was the common food. It was only recently in America, like in the 50s and 60s, that people started really keeping glot kosher, meaning they became stringent for those halachas as well, and they refused a higher percentage of animals, meaning fewer animals made it into the, and you know, onto people's tables. One of the first communities that really insisted on it was the Wiener community under the auspices of Johannes and Steif. He said, no, in this kehila, we're only eating glot kosher, we're raising the bar, and that's it. So one of Rabbi Yaakov's students from his yeshiva Torah Vadas got engaged to a girl from the Wiener community. And Torah Vadas, as in most of America at the time, they kept regular kosher, not glot kosher. So the question was asked, well, can the girl eat in the boy's house, right? Or in her in-law's house now? What's going to happen? So Rabbi Yaakov said, that's a very important question. Call the couple into my office right away. So the boy and his fiance came into Rabbi Yaakov's office, and Rabbi Yaakov was mater neder with her, that he took her through a process where if you observe a certain halacha in a way for a significant amount of time, that's considered as if you take it upon yourself as an oath to do it that way. And Rabbi Yaakov said, we have to be mater neder. There's a procedure you can release a person from their vows. So because she has always customarily eaten only glot, we have to go through this procedure to release her from that obligation. And he said it's very important to do so. We find that when Chazal wanted to drive a wedge, a social wedge, between Jews and non-Jews, they did it in the area of food. Like you can't eat food, certain foods cooked by a non-Jew, you can't drink wine touched by a non-Jew. And they did that for social reasons, because they knew that people bond over food and their ability to share food. In a marriage, if the husband and wife feel some discomfort with each other in terms of sharing food, then that's driving a wedge which the Torah does not allow whatsoever in a marriage. No wedges allowed. So because of that, they matred the neder for the girl so that she could freely and with a clear conscience partake of the food that she would be eating in her in-law's house. Okay, going over time, we'll have to finish the paragraph next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.